an epidemic of invalid sacraments and nonsensical Trump indictments. In this 48th episode of Church and State, Brian McCall and Christopher Ferrara discuss the latest doctrinal note from the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, addressing sacramental validity, called Gestis Verbisque, and the latest developments in the farcical indictments from the D.C. Circuit against former President Donald Trump.
Welcome to another edition of Church and State with Brian McCall and Chris Ferrara, where we are documenting and commenting on the implosion of church and state in our times.
I was going to ask when you introduced it, do we still have a church? Is there still a state? Do we have a state still?
Well, we
cannot hold. Things fall apart. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world.
I don't know. The D.C. Circuit might have declared it doesn't exist anymore. I don't know. We'll see.
I think the D.C. Circuit has a short circuit. We'll get to that.
But first, in Rome, there's an interesting story. A lot of conservative people have been sort of clapping their hands and see everything's fine in the church. The kissing cardinal, who is the part-time Dr. Ruth sex advisor, Tucho Fernandez, issued a new document on the validity of sacraments. And unlike his last document, Fiducia's supplicans, or more accurately, sodomite supplicans, he actually consulted with the dicastery that he's the head of, right? The one for the gay blessing thing, he just, in Francis-like fashion, just declared it the case. This one, he did actually go through the process of getting the consultors of the dicastery, the doctor of the faith.
You mean, well, the die was castery?
Exactly. Exactly. So what's interesting about this one, first of all, just it's the sort of decomposition of the whole conciliar church. It has a Latin name. It's actually a note that was issued by the dicastery, but it actually doesn't have a Latin text. The Vatican only published it in Italian. Like, that's sort of the state of the post-conciliar church.
Too much work.
I mean, they used to actually, you know, the document was in Latin. That was the official document. And then you translated it for people who might not know Latin, like the news media. Well, this is called Gestis Verbisque. And that's the end of the Latin. Then it goes into Italian.
What's the first two words in Italian? I haven't even seen this document, so.
Well, it's a very intense, concise 11-page document.
Wow.
But basically, they announced it. They had the press conference. They said, we had to issue this because we're too busy at the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith with all these people writing in about their invalid sacraments and a bunch of priests who found out they were actually never baptized. And it's kind of a mess dealing with this. So people stop doing that. I mean, that's essentially what he explained. And this is not a problem. You don't see this a problem that you're getting so many cases of invalid sacraments that you had to say something about it. You know, hello, Houston, I think we have a problem. So they basically say, stop messing with the form and the matter. And it is really interesting because they don't want to draw connections between the post-conciliar, open everything up, you know, come as you are, be as you like, ad lib it mentality, and the fact that then sacraments become invalid. So he basically, Fernandez says that there's plenty of room for experimentation and adaptation in the liturgy, but when it comes to the form of the sacrament, like, you should just say the words. And he keeps sort of repeating this over and over again, that thanks to Vatican II, we don't have a liturgy that is rigid anymore. He says, the liturgy allows for variety that preserves the church from a rigid uniformity, thanks to Sacrosanctum Concilium. But, you know, like, you shouldn't be saying in the name of the creator, the mother, and the guy, because then you're not really conferring the sacrament. So.
Well, I'm looking at the Italian now, yeah. And of course the first few words of the Italian have nothing to do with the titles. I don't know where they got that title from.
It's from the non-existent Latin text.
So he says, you know, there's a bit of a problem here. We're hearing about things like, for example, baptizing in the name of the creator. Or in the name of the Father and the Mother, I baptize you. Yes, this is a problem. We need to do something about that.
But again, they don't see the root of the problem. Like, the whole problem is the whole Mass of Paul VI is filled with the celebrant in these or similar words. The celebrant can have choice A through triple Z, right? It's, and then they say, but you know, but don't change those couple of words there. They don't understand they've created this whole mentality where nothing really matters. You can do whatever you want. And then they're upset when priests are actually doing that.
Well, it was obvious here that what we're seeing from the Vatican is this call to be absolutely rigid and adhere to rigid formulas.
Yes.
like the Pharisees did. We can't have these rigid formulae. I mean, as long as you have the right intention, why can't you just say, you're baptized, welcome to the community. What's the problem?
Yeah, I mean, what do we need the water for? Have a glass of orange juice.
I haven't read the document, as they say, but did they give an explanation of why a literal adherence to the form of the sacrament is necessary to its validity?
Well, they essentially say what Vatican II taught us is we can change everything except the bare essence of the sacrament.
Why, though? Why can't you change that?
No explanation.
On what ground do they stand, I might ask? when they defend the literal language of the sacramental form being absolutely, strictly, rigidly required.
Well, they're doing that, but they don't, remember, we don't want a rigid uniformity in the liturgy, even though we only have one form of the Roman Rite. Yeah.
Well, at the same time that they defend the necessity of adhering to the literal form of the sacraments and make a half-hearted effort to deplore this development, they extol the absolute free fall in the liturgy where everyone can do as he pleases and mess with the order of the Mass or have all kinds of improvised communion rites. No problem at all. We even have the aboriginal rites now. Francis wants some sort of pagan ritual for the pagans who might have been baptized according to the rigid formula. But everything is in flux liturgically speaking, but somehow we're supposed to hold fast to a few literal words of the sacramental formulas. I don't see a rationale in that document.
But see,
all rationale is simple. We pass on what was handed down from apostolic times.
Right.
Including the Roman canon.
Exactly. Again, I think the real explanation here is purely political. So the Vatican's in the hot seat. Francis is taking shots from all sides for this gay blessing the couple, not the couple. Wait, no, wait, I'm not blessing. Actually, the best cartoon I saw in this was Gloria TV. They had a picture of Herod and Herodias embracing each other and Pope Francis standing there saying, I'm blessing you individually, not as a couple, while John the Baptist's head is lying on the platter in front of him. So again, they're taking heed from all over the world. This Fernandez guy is caught with his pornography everywhere. So I think this is all calculated. Oh, let's put this out. We'll manipulate the sycophants who worship at the throne of papal idolatry, and we'll throw them a bone that they can say, oh, look, see, everything's great. Francis is taking care of liturgical abuse, and not one single person will actually be stopped from committing liturgical abuse.
You know, what you just described as their desperate attempts to shore themselves up, that reminds me of what I used to say not too many years ago about good news coming from the Vatican in dribs and drabs. We don't want good news coming from the Vatican. We want only bad news. Bad news is good news. Because the more bad news we get, the worse it gets. The closer we come to a turnaround in the restoration. And that's what we're seeing here. I mean, this is the final extremity of the post-conciliar revolution. Anybody with any sense, anybody who cares at all about the faith can now see something is radically wrong with the great renewal or the new orientation of the church since Vatican II, which is why we want it to get worse, because if it doesn't get worse, we're going to have this lingering illness, which is already paralyzing the mystical body, decommissioning the church, as one commentator put it, demissionizing the church. That would go on forever until the illness gets worse. You have to have the fever peak, and then it has to break. And now we're at the fever pitch, the height of the fever, and maybe the fever is about to break at long last. So bring it on is what I say. You know, completely demolish your credibility. There's one ridiculous provision after another, and then come forth and say, oh, by the way, you really need to adhere to the validity of the sacraments.
Right.
So it's good. I mean, this is a parallel to the state, too, where everything seems to be falling apart. And yet, the more they attempt to make the situation untenable, the worse it gets, the greater we see the possibility that the whole thing will collapse in a heap on top of them. As, for example, in the Senate, they just defeated the ridiculous so-called border bill.
the border bill that shut the border except for like 1.5 million illegal people.
Right? Yeah, so, yeah, things have gotten so radically bad that even a lot of Democrats are waking up and saying, really, is there any option besides Trump? His support among black voters is at an all-time high. It's dropped about 20% of the Democrats because black people are realizing, what actually have the Democrats done for us other than put us on the reservation, so to speak, of total dependency on the Democrat Party for measures, social measures that have actually destroyed the nuclear family. So people are waking up. So what we say in all of these shows is the same thing. At the peak of the crisis, that's when we're going to see the beginning of a restoration. We're at the peak now, obviously. Yeah.
And you're right about the parallels we shift over there, because as the more this turns into a banana republic, the more that the Democrats go around chanting the slogans of, we are a government of laws, not of men. No one is, no person is above the law. We're, when they're going around, you know, saying we are a government of thugs, not of laws, and only Trump is subject to the law, and they're all above the law. So we have yet another example of this in one of the hundreds of indictments brought against Trump. We had a little movement on that. I mean, it's almost like those counters, like, you know, how many people are murdered every so many minutes. It's like, how many indictments have come out in the last 5 minutes? But one of his cases, the one in DC on the so-called election interference January 6th insurrection case, Trump appealed and said, stop this trial. I have presidential immunity. I made a speech as president of the United States on a matter of public concern, and I cannot be prosecuted for that. Unanimously, surprisingly, for such a conservative bastion, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals slapped him down.
How do people know you're being sarcastic?
It's the only thing to do with these people.
The D.C. Circus, as we like to call it.
The D.C. Circus of Appeals, right. Slapped him down, said, you're not immune. Not at all. Not at all. Citizen Trump. Go back, comrade, to the gulag.
Oh, yeah. Here's the delightful thing about this absolutely preposterous decision. Oh, yes, there's presidential immunity, but not when you leave office. Oh, what good is it?
What good is it?
Well, listen to this quote from the decision. Now, even a liberal commentator, one Jack Goldsmith, writing at lawfaremedia.com, he points this out. I saw this immediately in the decision. Here's what the D.C. Circuit said about why Trump should not be given immunity. It's in this section, section 3A. Instead of inhibiting the president's lawful discretionary action, the prospect of federal criminal liability might serve as a structural benefit to deter possible abuses of power and criminal behavior, end quote. So in other words, and this liberal commentator says, whoa, wait, this is a disaster. You can't have this where there's now a fourth branch of government, essentially, that activates after the president leaves office. The fourth branch is any prosecutor who decides to indict the president for anything. And according to the D.C. Circus, well, that's a good idea because it will inhibit the president's actions. He'll be so afraid of criminal liability, he won't do X, Y, or Z. And that's exactly why we need presidential immunity.
Well, that's exactly what the deep state wants. They want a president who is paralyzed and can't do anything so they can just carry on.
If it's Trump.
Right. If it's Trump. Well, frankly, even if it's not. I mean, I think they're thrilled that Biden is a walking bag of bones without a brain, because they don't really want a president to interfere with their incredible plans to give us this brave new world that they're creating in their little bureaucratic offices in D.C. on our dime.
What Goldsmith says is, well, the problem with this reasoning that the threat of criminal liability hanging over the president like a Damoclean sword is a good thing because it will cause the president to think carefully about everything he does. That's not a good thing, says this article, says Goldsmith, because this could affect Biden. You could indict Biden for all kinds of things.
For example, facilitating an invasion of the country?
Oh, you could make a nice RICO case out of his collusion with the cartels and the NGOs, who are also colluding with the cartels. It's a vast criminal enterprise. So he says we need some sort of cleanup of this D.C. Circuit opinion to have a tighter rule for which criminal statutes can be applied to a president after he leaves office. Well, that's very tricky. How do we know which criminal statutes it would be? Well, the answer obviously implicit here with Goldsmith is, well, whatever criminal statute is applied to Trump.
Right, exactly.
So he wants, basically, this article is really arguing, the sub rosa text here is, essentially we need a Trump immunity, which is limited to whatever situation arises where he can be indicted. And then we need a non-Trump immunity that benefits all the other presidents.
Right. Well, and again, this case is really, I mean, absolutely absurd, because what they're saying is he went and made a speech. Now, again, just seems obviously the president is not immune if he just wakes up one night and decides to go rob a bank. He's like, well, I'm president. Okay, after he leaves office, in his private capacity, he went and robbed a bank. We're not talking about that. This is the president of the United States speaking about an issue of public concern, the integrity of the elections in the country, exercising his First Amendment right to engage in the political process. And, you know, that is what they sort of want to put him on trial for.
Well, here's the problem with the Jack Smith indictment. If you read it, you see that it's utter nonsense. He's basically indicting the president for engaging in First Amendment protected activity. Here's paragraph 3. The defendant had a right, like every American, to speak publicly about the election and even to claim falsely that there had been outcome determinative fraud during the election and that he had won. He was also entitled to formally challenge the results of the election through lawful and appropriate means. Indeed, in many cases, the defendant did pursue these methods. Well, then what did he do wrong? Well, he goes on to say that he did things like spread false information about the election.
Right.
The very thing he said Trump can do under the First Amendment. So the indictment is nonsense. In terms of the scope of presidential immunity, you're absolutely right. The D.C. Circuit, one of the judges on there, I forget which one, the most liberal of the three, I think, said, well, can the president order SEAL Team 6 to go assassinate one of his political opponents? The scope of presidential immunity, like the immunities given to other officials, is simply what would be within the authority of their office.
Right.
We use the Latin phrase ultra virus. It's beyond the limits of the office. If an act is beyond the limits of what an office is empowered to do, what the officer, or in this case, the president, who's not an officer, but the actual executive branch, has the power to do, if it exceeds that, okay, then say a bank robbery would exceed presidential authority. Or ordering SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival. Well, that's a garden variety crime of murder. But nothing in this indictment follows that limitation. He's being indicted for speaking and acting in ways none of which are in themselves criminal. Here's, listen to this, paragraph 11. The defendant's knowledge of the falsity of his election fraud claims. That's paragraph 11. Now, didn't he say in paragraph 3 that Trump has the right to say things even that are false about the election? Well, then he goes to paragraph 11, the defendant's knowledge of the falsity of his election fraud claims. So he's basically saying a politician can be indicted for saying things that aren't true. That's what he's saying.
Well, it's interesting, that example, why he didn't pick the example, if a president ordered the executive branch to bring false charges against his opponent in an election. He could, I wonder why he didn't use that example. That hypothetical. Wait, it's not a hypothetical. That's why.
Well, you know, he says the president has the right to make claims about election fraud, even if they're false. But then in paragraph 12, he says, the defendant insinuated that more than 10,000 dead voters had voted in Georgia. Well, didn't you say that a false statement is protected by the First Amendment? I don't get it. What is this indictment all about? So if this is not covered by presidential immunity, making claims about election fraud, which every politician who loses does, including Hillary, if that's not within presidential immunity, then there is no presidential immunity. So the Supreme Court has to take this case, because if they accept the D.C. Circuit's reasoning, absolutely any criminal statute that an inventive prosecutor could contrive to cover something the president did while in office would support an indictment of any president the minute he leaves office, so that there really is zero presidential immunity. The Supreme Court has to wrestle with this question.
Absolutely. And I guess the only good thing coming out of this is it's finally going to get kicked up to the Supreme Court.
Because
the D.C. Circuit knew it. They basically said, but our writ of mandamus, we're not doing anything with it until February 12th because we assume he's going to appeal.
Yeah, but then he has to make an application for a stay.
Yes.
And if the stay isn't granted by the Supreme Court, then the mandamus will issue. In other words, the D.C. Circuit will tell the trial court, go ahead.
Right.
Start the trial proceedings. So the Supreme Court would have to grant a stay. Now, my thinking is They might grant an administrative stay. In other words, it's not a merits-based stay. They don't have to reach the standard that Trump is likely to succeed. It would just be an administrative stay saying, oh, wait a minute, let's just look at this. We'll worry about the merits later. Right now, we're just going to stay in administratively. And they could sit on that until the end of the term, which means there's no trial until after the election, if there ever is a trial.
I don't know. Any predictions on what you think they'll do?
Well, the Supremes?
The Supremes, yeah.
I have no idea. I have no idea. I mean, the Colorado argument, this is a Wednesday night, Colorado argument about moving Trump from the ballot, that's on tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, and anyone who wants to can go to the Supreme Court website and tune into that.
But didn't they only grant like 10 minutes?
10 minutes to one of the lunatics.
Oh, just to one of the lunatics.
I think it was the Secretary of State. That nutcase got 10 minutes.
Okay.
But the petitioner got 20 or 40, actually, and I think the respondent got 40. The whack job Secretary of State got 10 minutes.
Okay, I just seen that report. I just thought they had granted the whole
thing. So they really have to put Trump on the ballot in Colorado or everywhere else, because if the Supreme Court were to allow this to stand, that's the end of whatever we like to call the Republican America. It's all over.
Wait, in the name of defending democracy, we're not allowing you to have an election.
No one is above the law, Brian. Don't you know that?
We are a government of laws, not
a man. No one is allowed to say that they stole votes in Georgia. Don't you know that? Right. That's a crime.
Well, we have to end democracy in order to save democracy, of course. Yes.
So here we go. Another week of bad news. But as we said, you know, earlier, the worse the news gets, the more hope we have that we're reaching the end. And I'm hoping we live to see it. It's coming for sure. Yeah. The complete turnabout, the miraculous restoration of things. Because we have to have that before actually the end times, when Enoch and Elias return and the Antichrist is opposing them, and there's the ingathering of the Jews and all the things that traditional Catholic prophecy predicts. We're nowhere near that yet. So there must be an interregnum of a restoration of some kind. It's coming.
Well, and you're right. I think in the state, the more absurd these people get, the more radical they get, the more stupid they get, putting Fannie Willis in charge of the case in Georgia, the more people are just going, this is insane. I can't believe people who would have gone along with it can't. And I think a great example of that, their little plan to get rid of Trump, to prop up the Democrats, to prop up Nikki Haley as the Republican nominee, is just utterly falling apart. People are, you know, I was worried, oh, people won't see through this. They'll think, well, yesterday in Nevada, she ran as the only candidate on the ballot. It's kind of complicated. It's not really, they don't really have a primary. They have a caucus, but the Democrats tried to make the Republicans have a primary. So Trump said, I'm not playing games. So Nikki Haley ran all by herself and lost.
To none of the above.
Yes, it was Nikki Haley or none. And none of the above got like 60% of the vote and she got 30%. So I took such hope from that people are so woken up to this that they don't even fall for – they were going to have her claim to have won the primary in Nevada against herself, and they can't even do that.
That's why I say it's better to have a massive wound and bleed it out than to have the death of 1,000 cuts.
Yes.
And thanks to Francis, he's doing us a favor in an inverse way.
Yes.
By – just bringing to a conclusion the logic of Vatican II, which is really the dissolution of traditional Roman Catholicism. I mean, he's openly said that's what he wants to do. He hates traditional Catholicism.
Now, he's made that very clear.
I understand why young people are attracted to it. What's with these young people? They must be sick in the head, says Francis.
Exactly. And you've pointed out many times, he basically accuses traditional people of everything he is himself.
Well, the only offense now is suspicion of orthodoxy, which is a good sign.
Which is a good sign. Very true. Well, as we said, we should laugh at this, laugh at the absurdity, and, you know, remember that Our Lady has promised us that her Immaculate Heart would triumph, which reminds us, the Fatima Center is promoting a First Saturday challenge, 100 by 100, a challenge to present a spiritual bouquet to Our Lady. All Catholics to unite to fulfill Our Lady's request to offer a spiritual bouquet of 100,000 first Saturdays for the 100th anniversary of Our Lady's request. So you can go to the Fatima Center website at fatima.org and learn about that. And again, we can't vote for the Pope. We can't vote for the next Pope. We can't choose the next Pope. We can't consecrate Russia. We can cast our one little vote in the presidential election, but we can't snap our fingers and change the resident in chief, get him out of the Oval Office or his sound studio, wherever he is. But what we can do is do what Our Lady asks. Pray the rosary, make sacrifices, do the five first Saturdays. That's within our control. So it's a great program that they've a great call from the Fatima Center. So take a look at it.
Above all, the rosary, which has changed the course of history more than once.
Absolutely. All right, Chris, there we have it. We'll see what crazy opinions are issued from the judicial system the next time we meet. Maybe we'll
By the next time we have an issue, in addition of church and state, there'll be huge developments in the attacks on Trump. So we'll have something more to talk about then.
So check back in a couple weeks.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care. God bless.
This episode of Church and State is brought to you by the Fatima Center. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved. For more resources and to support this vital apostolate with your donation, visit our website, fatima.org, or call us at 1-800-263-8160. And please join us in offering Our Lady a spiritual bouquet of 100,000 First Saturdays for the 100th anniversary of Our Lady's request of this devotion. Sign up for this First Saturday Challenge, 100 by 100. Update your status and track our progress around the world at fatima.org, 100 by 100. Along with the consecration of Russia, the First Saturday devotion is one of the two principal means by which God wills to establish in the world devotion to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. For peace in the world and in the Church, and more importantly, for the conversion and salvation of many souls, it is essential that every Catholic live the Fatima message. Our Lady of the Rosary, pray for us. Long live Christ the King.